Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And as always, along with your call, some interesting topics, Zorba?
Yes, we're going to talk about longevity in Japan. People there live longer than anywhere else in the world. And then we're going to talk about wandering minds and whether or not wandering minds will interfere with your longevity.
Talking about, what? What's our recipe?
Chicken lettuce cups with hoisin sauce. Delicious.
800-462-7413. Toll free, of course. Let's welcome our first caller, Zorba, a listener with us in Seymour, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I guess my question today is about weight fluctuations. Throughout my life, especially in the last 2 or 3 years, my friends and my family, more than me, have noticed that I don't gain weight. I only seem to lose it. It's never really bothered me. I enjoy it, but my diet consists mainly of the normal college diet. I eat, burgers, McDonald's, French fries.
Yeah.
Especially in the last month, I haven't had a single vegetable or fruit that I can think of. So I'm just wondering how it is possible that in the last month, I've actually managed, 3 weeks less, I've lost 23 pounds.
What?
Without doing any kind of exercise and eating only things that should turn me into a whale.
What? Can I ask how old you are and how much you weigh?
I am 21. I was 179 2.5 weeks ago, and I am now 153.
Oh, that's a huge.
And you haven't had any change in diet at all?
No, not at all.
Uh-huh. Are you urinating a lot, quite a bit?
Normally, I would suppose.
Uh-huh. No. One of the reasons I asked for is that weight loss can be accompanied with diabetes. In other words, what we do is we spill sugar into our urine, and weight loss can be a common symptom, and it was years ago. So you feel okay? That's a lot of weight to lose, to go from.
In three weeks.
How tall are you?
I'm about 6 feet.
So you're 6'11". Okay, so you're really a thin guy. Tell me a bit about your mom and your dad.
They're about average, maybe even a little bit over.
Uh-huh. So, because one of the things we know that 5% of the population deals with weight at the other end of the spectrum. They're thin and they'd like to actually gain weight. But we're usually talking about a pound or 2 pounds. That is an awful lot of weight to lose in that period of time. And you say you're eating as much as you normally do or as much as you want to?
I'm one of those people, I don't have much willpower. So, when I eat, I eat, and I eat all day. I will eat 3 portions of something and then be hungry 20 minutes later.
Uh-huh. What do you do for exercise?
On the rare occasions that I actually decide to move more than I am required to, I will do a few reps of sit-ups, a few push-ups, but that's maybe once a week.
Okay, so you're not doing much exercise. Okay,
no.
I've got some specific things. First of all, that's a lot of weight to lose. And losing that much weight actually is a red flag. In other words, there's something going on. And you really want to actually, get a checkup from your physician to see what's happening for that amount of weight loss. Because that is a ton of weight to lose in that period of time, especially since your diet is the same and you eat as much as you want to. There's something going on here.
I don't really see it as a problem.
Well, it might be. Have you ever been – when were you at this weight before, 153? Is that your normal weight? What were you a year ago?
Well, for most of my life, between middle school and the end of high school, I was the same weight. Uh-huh. I was 150.
150,
For that entire time, and with a variance of about 1 or 2 pounds.
So is 179 heavy for you? Were you trying to gain weight, and you're back down to your normal weight?
No, I guess I started college in, the ramen diet.
Uh-huh.
But then after that, went back down to the 150s.
Well, so. you know, I'll tell you something interesting. Here's another explanation for what's going on. So you went to college and you got what we used to call the freshman 20.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you graduated high school at the weight of about 150, 155, this may be your natural weight. And it may be that the 179 was an abnormal weight because you were eating differently when you were at that weight. And so that's the other explanation. I kind of monitor it, see how you feel. Like you said, you obviously don't feel like there's a problem, which means physiologically you're okay. And maybe what we're actually looking at was an abnormal weight when you were 170.
Okay.
It's another way of looking at it. So, well, thank you so much for your call. Very interesting. You know, most people who call our show want to lose weight. You're the rare bird who wants to gain it. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, we appreciate the call. That's kind of unbelievable.
Well, but that's an interesting other explanation. Here it is. If you're normally 179, you lose 20 pounds or more than 20 pounds. You're down to 153. You go, what's going on? I'm losing weight. But if you're normally around 153 and it happened that you went up to 179
but
because you ate the carbohydrates.
Time.
Yeah, but people change their diet. Some people are remarkably stable with their diet. You're one of those people.
Yeah.
You eat as much as you want to, and when I went on my recent trip to Nepal, I lost 10 pounds and I came back and I knew, because I've done this before, I would probably gain the weight back. And I ate as much as I wanted to. And here it is, you know, a month and a half later, and I'm almost back to my regular weight.
You'd still recommend a visit to the doctor.
Yeah, because I think that amount of weight loss, I worry about that and whether or not thin people can get diabetes just like overweight people.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Now, Zorba, listener with us in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hello there.
How can we help?
My question has to do with cholesterol management, particularly for patients who have cardiac disease. I've had one negative reaction to a particular statin drug, and I'm interested in knowing your opinion on red yeast rice as a natural alternative. My doctor prefers, of course, a statin drug, mm-hmm. which I'm on, another one, and so far, after about a month on it, everything seems to be okay. But I'm just curious about the alternative.
Yeah, Zorba's going to want to know what your cholesterol count is.
Yeah, so what are your counts?
Well, before I got on this new drug, it was 247.
Uh-huh.
Recently, in just a blood test last week, and it had come down to 114.
Oh, that comes down quite a bit. Do you know what your bad cholesterol is, the LDL or the bad stuff?
Currently, on this new drug, the LDL was 73.
Uh huh.
Before that, it was 151.
Okay, and you've got known heart disease? Is that
yes,
what you? Okay.
Uh-huh.
So let me give you the skinny.
Okay.
On exactly that type of thing. First of all, statin drugs have been around now for a long time, 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
We know that statin drugs prevent a second heart attack. There's data on that. It's very strong. I think it's irrefutable data. And reducing risk is the name of the game. Let me make an analogy. Seatbelts. As we were starting seatbelts, when I was a kid, there were no seatbelts. And then people said, well, I don't want to wear a seatbelt. What if the car is burning and I'll never get the seatbelt off? And over time, we did, you know, great studies and basically showed that your chances of surviving a car crash were 5 times better with a seatbelt than without. Mm-hmm. And so you've got the occasional time when the person wears the seatbelt and they can't get out of the car while it's burning, but that is a really rare event. So we've now accepted seatbelts save lives. Laws were passed. We wear seatbelts. That's what we do. Statin drugs are in a very similar way where they're known to reduce heart attacks. Cholesterol is what they reduce it from, but they actually have other properties that appear to stabilize the cholesterol plaques that are in the body. It's not just the reduction of cholesterol, because other drugs that reduce cholesterol do not seem to have the same properties at all. There's not proof, for instance, that niacin, which was a commonly used drug that increases HDL or good cholesterol, reduces heart attacks. There's really no good evidence. There are other drugs, such as a drug called Lopid, an older drug which was on the market, reduces cholesterol. No good evidence that it actually stops heart attacks. So we care about second heart attacks, and statin drugs are good. The problem is some people don't tolerate them. So there are a number statin drugs on the market. I think there are five now. And what you do is you go through the cheapest ones first. And then if they don't work, then you consider the name brand, of which there's one, Crestor. And frankly, Lipitor is a dynamite drug. And Zocor, the other drug in that class, was dynamite true. Now, red yeast. Well, there are a couple of things with red yeast. First of all, red yeast from China was tainted with lovastatin, which is a cholesterol drug. In other words, they were actually putting cholesterol drugs into the red yeast that people were taking from China and saying, well, this is a natural product. And in fact, it wasn't. It was tainted with drug. And the FDA had a cease and desist order. But there's some evidence that some newer red yeast drugs produce a substance which is very much like statins. I don't like that in the fact that they're not regulated by the FDA. You don't know how much red yeast you're getting. But if you decide you want to do it, and that's not my recommendation, go to consumerlabs.org, O-R-G, consumerlabs, L-A-B-S, .org. Go in there and then only use the ones they test. But my recommendation for you, you're tolerating the statin, stay on it. So good
luck.
Well,
that coincides with exactly what my doctor was saying to me.
Well, there you go.
Reducing the risk. But you two are together.
There we are. There we are.
Thanks for the call.
Well, great. I appreciate the information.
Bye-bye.
Well, thank you.
Remember in the dark ages when we started doing the show, Zorba, there was this big argument about whether cholesterol mattered.
Yes, right. That's right. Back in the dark ages.
The jury, I think, is in.
The jury is in. Absolutely.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, before our next caller, we find out that Japan, I think, once again, tops the list of healthiest countries.
That's right. It's clear that if you and I move to Japan, we'll live longer.
Yeah, absolutely.
It must be the climate. It must be the climate around Tokyo.
Certainly
can't and other
be
places.
Diet.
Can't
or,
be
or
diet.
Exercise.
Can't be exercise. Can't be genetics. It
right.
must be the climate. You know, they used to say way in the mountains of Tibet or on Crete or on Cyprus, you know, exotic, those are all exotic places, you know, or in the middle of, you know, the Pakistani mountains that nobody ever comes to. People live a long life. But here it is. They live in Tokyo and they live so long. It's very interesting. We look at healthy male and female life expectancy because the numbers have just come out. Japan is number one. Singapore for guys is number two. Mm-hmm. Switzerland is number three. Then we get to Spain and Italy. Now, of those places, where would you like to be? Would you like to be in Singapore, Switzerland, Japan, Spain, or Italy? Pick them.
I think probably Spain would be.
I think Spain or
Italy.
Italy would be good,
too.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know?
Isn't
you know,
France on that list?
I think it's
anywhere?
Okay. No, France is not. You know, then we've got Canada. Believe it or not, Israel. Believe it now, we are way down the list. You know, we're around the area with about South Korea. So the United States doesn't look like it's really very good. But what the data masks is middle class versus middle class. In other words, if we look at it from a financial point of view, if you look at not Japan, Japan is a very interesting society. Mm-hmm. There's not much of a difference between the richest people and we'll say the people that are middle class people. Mm-hmm. You know, I was reading executive pay in Japan is often the head of the company makes four times the person who works in the country. And in the U.S., it's some huge amount. And in Singapore, it's the same thing. There's a lot of similarity in terms of middle classdom. If you look at middle class versus middle class, they're actually pretty similar.
When you say middle class, from country to country,
from
is that
country
what you're
to country?
So in Japan and the United States,
right?
We in the middle class are pretty much the same.
Are often very similar within a year or two. The differences are not quite as stark.
Well, then why are we even talking about?
Well, because
I don't care.
because we're talking. We're national country. It's everything. That's exactly it. Now I've got a prediction. My prediction is that as we are going to have more universal health care in this country, there's no doubt about it, and I'm unabashedly on the side for the fact that everyone should have access to medical care, especially preventive services.
Yeah.
As that gets rolled out 20 years later, and we'll still be doing the show 20 years from now, we'll just be still doing the show, that the differences are going to decrease. Because part of this, I think, is access to medical care that we have not previously
had
in
this country. So in Japan, they have really good access?
Yeah, they have total access to medical care. And in fact, they see doctors far more often than we do. And what's fascinating is doctors prescribe medicines from their office, and they make money on the prescription drugs that they prescribe.
Oh, they're like the pharmacists?
They're the phar- pharmacist and the doctor, and they prescribe more drugs than we do. So I'm not exactly sure whether or not we're going to go that route where the doctors are actually handing out the drugs in the office. I think there'd be a problem in our society. Nonetheless, if you want to live a long life, you've got Japan, Singapore, Switzerland. I'm heading to Spain and Italy. That's where I'm going to do my – that's where I'm doing my retirement.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, a listener with us in Buffalo, New York. Hi.
Hi, this is Mary in Buffalo.
Yeah, Mary.
And I would just add, if you want to live a long life, eat chicken wings in moderation.
That would be buffalo wings she's talking about.
Okay. Well, thank you for the opportunity to have this nagging question answered.
Mm-hmm.
A while back, I was in the grocery store, and I was approaching the vegetable oils, and there was a woman, an elderly woman, standing there. And she asked me if I knew anything about olive oils. And I said, well, no, not really, just that it's a healthier alternative than, you know, say, butter or bacon fat or, you know, for cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that she just came from the doctor, and the doctor told her to use extra virgin olive oil, but to be sure to get first cold pressed. And I was thinking maybe he told her to use first cold pressed because it tastes better. So my question to you is first cold pressed better for you than other extra virgin olive oils, or is it more flavorful?
Mm-hmm. Zorba loves this question, and I hope you have 10 or 15 minutes because he can go on and on and on about olive oil. Anything
okay,
you ever
I'll
wanted to know about olive
then.
Oil, here's your expert.
Okay, you know, thank you.
You would think that I had stock in an olive oil. You know, full disclosure, I own an olive oil grove.
No,
I don't think so.
But you love olive oil.
I love olive oil. And the reality is it's only a taste difference. That's all it is. If you look at olive oils, there's pure olive oil. That's what they call it. And that basically is olive oil that does not have as much flavor. And the first pressing, I don't think – there is a hot press olive oil, but most olive oil I think is cold press. They put it in and they press it and they have some way of getting the oil out of it. I'm not exactly sure how it is. But it's all a taste difference. So when she was sitting down with her doc, maybe he was talking about the taste differences that occur in olive oil. But there's no substantive difference in terms of olive oil and the good oil that it has. And olive oil, canola oil are the great oils to use. You know, it's clear that vegetable oils are generally better. And what I do is I reserve butter, which is an animal fat, and I reserve it for things that I really like. I love it on toast in the morning, so I'll often use it. And I'll use it for cooking certain things because I think certain things really taste better. But I use a lot of olive oil.
So as far as health or anything else, there's no difference
there's
with
no
extra
difference.
Virgin?
Not at all. There's no difference at all. Extra virgin olive oil just tastes better. And for someone, Tom, who has taste – this is an important thing.
You're looking down your nose.
That's right. Exactly. I'm looking down my nose. That's exactly it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for answering that question.
Yeah, we appreciate the call. Thank you. While back when you were talking about longevity,
yes,
you mentioned the island of Crete.
Yes.
A couple of years ago when I was in the Navy, I was on the island of Crete, and they have a lot of olive trees
on
Crete.
Wonderful.
And the wisdom was that people lived longer on Crete because of all the olive oil.
That may have just been the case. And by the way, when you said that, you said a couple of years
ago. Let's move right along. Before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's play a round of Stump the Doc. Today's contestant is Don in River Falls, Wisconsin, who has a soul-wrenching dilemma for you to solve. He writes, "Dear Dr. Pastor, I suffer from hot soles. At night, the bottoms of my feet get so hot that I have to leave them outside the covers. I even have to take off my shoes during the day, and the problem gets worse when I walk. It's been this way for 25 years, and even though it's not disabling, it's very annoying. I currently soak my feet in cold water, but is there anything else to be done?"
You know, this is really stump the doctor, stump the doctor. Well, Hot feet can be from neurological problems in the peripheral nerves. So, for instance, for people with diabetes, sometimes they complain about hot feet. They say, my feet are hot and they hurt and they feel uncomfortable. I have a patient of mine who says she has a hot poker. She's had it for 20 years because she's a diabetic. Now, I don't know if our gentleman is a diabetic, but that would be one cause. Mm-hmm. But there are peripheral neuropathies, which are diseases that occur in the peripheral nerves. And there are a whole list of them. If you Google the word peripheral neuropathies, you'll see a bunch of things from B12 deficiencies all on down the tree that would cause it. Now, 25 years is a long time to have it. Can come from an injury and other things. But you've stumped me in that I can't give you one answer. But I will tell you that if you come to our website, ZorbaPastor.org, we will give you a list of problems that it can cause hot feet. As I said, peripheral neuropathy is the name of the game. And good luck, because if you'll notice, I am not giving you an answer because there is no answer to the problem. So soaking your feet may be indeed what you should do.
Great information in that response. Are you hot on the heels of a medical mystery? Send your story to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up. You'll be interested in that. More of your calls, of course. Some more interesting research to talk over. And our medical myth buster, too, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. To the phones we go in a while, but right now, recipe time, Zorba. And this week we have a special guest author joining in the fun. Today's chef is unique in that her recipes are more about what she's leaving out than what she's putting in. Sibel Pascal is the author of the cookbook Allergy Free and Easy Cooking, which specializes in creating recipes safe for folks with food allergies. Every dish can be made in under 30 minutes and is free of gluten, wheat, dairy, eggs, soy, peanuts, tree nuts, fish, shellfish, and sesame. And she not only has this recipe, but 75 in the cookbook. Today's allergy-free recipe is for chicken lettuce cups with hoisin sauce. So, let's welcome to the show, Sibel. What got you interested in allergy-free cooking?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. I'm excited to be able to talk about this recipe because
it's actually one of my favorite
in the book.
Okay.
What got me involved in allergy-free cooking is my son, Lennon, who is now 11, was diagnosed with multiple severe food allergies when he was 4 months old. So I was breastfeeding him at the time, and so I had to stop eating the top 8 allergens so that he didn't get the traces of them. So my background actually was I'm a professional writer, but I had worked as a survival job as a cook in restaurants. So luckily I was sort of armed for the job and was able to start creating allergy-friendly recipes that were free at the top 8. And it just grew from there into a serendipitous profession for me, actually.
Really interesting. Chicken lettuce cups with hoisin sauce. Let's do it.
Okay, that sounds good. But I want to go back to survival job. You mean you couldn't survive as a writer at that time?
Well, starting when I was all the way back when I was 15, I started cooking in restaurants in the summertime. So, you know, that was something I really enjoyed. But I hadn't set my sights on being a professional chef or a cook.
Right. Well, what I find interesting about the book is that in my practice, I have people with multiple food allergies. And they're not necessarily vegans. They're not necessarily vegetarians. They may be omnivores, but they have to avoid gluten or wheat or dairy. There are a whole bunch of different issues. And for many people, it's hard for them to adapt recipes. They're just not creative cooks. So I find that good. So let's look at this. So chicken lettuce cups with hoisin sauce. And the hoisin sauce we're not going to go into. We're going to put that on our website, which I'll mention at the end. So let's go into the recipe. So start out with 1 tablespoonful of canola oil. 2 cloves of garlic, minced or pressed.
Exactly. Getting that nice Asian flavor, a teaspoon of freshly minced ginger, that gets you that nice Asian flavor.
Half cup of carrots, celery heart, and red bell peppers. So one half cup of all three of them.
Diced nice and fine for the crunch.
Nice and fine. 3 green onions, the white and the green part chopped. And then 5 ounces of water chestnuts, which, of course, we like. So you chop them over to pea size?
Exactly, and that's one of the ingredients that I'm using to replace the crunch that you would have from the roasted peanuts that you might have in here.
Mm-hmm. Excellent idea.
Or perhaps sometimes people put cashews, which is a tree nut. And chestnuts, by the way, are not a nut, even though it says chestnut.
Yes, they're not a nut. That's right, even though it says chestnut. Good to know. 1.5 pounds of ground dark meat chicken, because I assume it has more flavor than white meat.
Yeah, absolutely. I tried this recipe with white meat, and it just didn't have that punch that you need. It didn't have enough flavor. So the
Precisely.
Dark meat chicken is my favorite for
Which
this.
Which is good. 2 tablespoonfuls of chicken broth.
There's a brand, by the way, called Kitchen Basics, which makes allergen-free, gluten-free broths that are fantastic.
Okay, so Kitchen Basics. I think that's an important good tip for our listener. 6 tablespoonfuls of the soy sauce, of the hoisin sauce, rather, which we'll give the recipe on the website. 1 tablespoonful of rice vinegar. And then we're going to use black pepper, butter, or iceberg lettuce leaves. And I'm going to go through the recipe. So heat the canola oil in a nonstick wok or skillet over medium heat. Add the garlic and ginger. Cook, stirring for 30 minutes until fragrant.
Then 30 seconds.
30
not
seconds.
Minutes.
Oh, I'm sorry, 30 seconds.
You would end up with petrified garlic.
Well, there's nothing like misspeaking me there in 30 minutes. Add the carrots, celery, bell pepper, green onions, and water chestnuts. My face is turning red when I said 30 minutes. It's so funny. Cook for 4 minutes, stirring often. Then add the ground chicken and broth. Increase the heat to high. Sprinkle with a large pinch of salt. Cook, stirring often with a wooden spoon or spatula, breaking the chicken up into crumbles for 4 minutes or longer till there's no longer pink and it's starting to brown. Always an important point, because we always want to make sure that we get rid of any salmonella that may be in ground chicken. Then add 3 tablespoonfuls of the hoisin sauce, homemade, reserving the rest for alongside the lettuce cups. Stir in the rice vinegar. Bring to a simmer. Reduce the heat to low and cook at a slow simmer for 3 minutes. Adjust the salt and pepper to taste, and then serve with the lettuce leaf. Each diner, of course, makes his own bundles by spooning about 2 tablespoonfuls of the chicken mixture into each leaf, topping with a little bit of the remaining 3 tablespoonfuls of homemade hoisin sauce. Wrap it up. Eat. It's wonderful. Each serving is about 200 calories, and it sounds delish.
Thank you.
Delicious.
And I want to point out that this is also made in 30 minutes or less, as is every recipe in this book.
I like that. I like that. I like that. And of course, and you said you have 10 children at home?
I have 2, but they feel like 10. I have 2 boys. I have an 8 and an 11-year-old boy. So, yeah.
So it's important to do
this. Equivalent of 10.
It's wonderful. Thank you so much. It's really a wonderful recipe. It looks like a great cookbook, and we really appreciate it.
I hope you enjoy it. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you very much for joining us. To get a copy of today's recipe or to find out more about Sibel Pascal's latest book, Allergy Free and Easy Cooking, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're there, you can search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor On Your Health recipes. That's ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Now back to the phone, Zorba, a listener with us in El Paso, Texas. Hi.
Hello there.
How can we help?
So I have a quick question that came about when we were listening to your show and with an argument that my girlfriend and I were having.
Okay.
So
let me tell you, your girlfriend is right.
That's what she wants to hear, but I'm pretty sure I'm right.
Okay,
anyway, we were at a coffee shop, and I had to go to the bathroom. So I went, came back out right away, and my girlfriend says, "Hey, that was quick. I usually take that long just putting toilet paper on the seat."
Oh, okay.
I said, "Why do you do that?" And she said, "Well, because it's nasty if you don't." And we got into this whole thing where I'm telling her that I don't do that because that's just a waste of time. Time that could be better spent doing something else, and that it doesn't really have any benefits. She's kind of giving me the "Who are you?" look. I don't know what kind of person does this. So she claims that it's gross, and not only gross, well, but very, very unhealthy, and that I could get some sort of illness if I don't cover up the toilet seat with toilet paper. Now, she's not using those toilet seat covers. She says those aren't good, that it needs to be toilet paper because it's a lot thicker.
What?
Yeah, exactly. I really don't think it makes any difference whether you use a toilet seat cover, whether you use toilet paper to cover the toilet seat, or whether you just sit down, do your business, and get out of there quickly. So my question is, do those things really provide any sort of health benefit, or are they just there to waste time and make a profit for some company somewhere?
I love it. Waste time and make a profit. Hey, we live in a capitalist society. Profit is supposed to be good. Wasting time is supposed to be bad. We've got to be efficient. Well, first of all, when we look at disease that's spread by toilet seat, it really is non-existent. You know, people would say, oh, I had VD and I got venereal disease and STD from a toilet seat. And the answer, of course, is you can't get VD from a toilet seat. That is an old myth. Mm-hmm. Unless you're having sex on a toilet seat, you don't actually get any sexually transmitted disease. And if you look at toilet seats, on the whole, they're really not as dirty as people think they are. The bathroom itself may be disgusting. We've all gone into disgusting bathrooms. Bathrooms that smell and the floor is dirty, but the toilet seats are remarkably clean. But for some people, they want to make them a little bit cleaner because it makes them feel better and they wash their hands and, you know, there are a whole bunch of issues that are involved there. So what to do? Well, you've got a lot of options. First of all, you can have Purell little handy wipes and put them on the toilet seat and wipe it clean. That's number one. Easy, quick. Yes, it's a waste of time. From my point of view, on the other hand, I'm a guy and I don't sit on those disgusting toilet seats as much out in the public. You can do that. But if you're not going to do that, you can actually put anything on the toilet seat. It doesn't make a difference what it is. You know, you could cover it with newspaper and simply put a hole in the newspaper, and that would be just as good too. But toilet paper, toilet seat covers, it really doesn't make a difference. And there's some airports, like O'Hare Airport, where they've actually put toilet seat covers that run mechanically to make it into a clean toilet seat for people.
But you're saying it doesn't do anything.
Doesn't do anything. Now, visually inspecting the toilet seat to make sure that there is not particulate matter on the toilet seat can be extremely useful, and that's about where it is.
Yeah, and you'll tell your girlfriend that Zorba said that, and she will absolutely change her behavior and love you even more.
That's right. We got to tell you, as a guy, it's always important to get points with those women, and telling them they're right is extremely important. Don't you think that's the case, Tom?
Yeah, I just said the opposite of that. You weren't even listening. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye. 1-800-462-7413.
I'm looking for points. That's what? It. My wife listens to every single show, everything I say. No.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, what's up?
Well, I've kind of noticed over like the past several years where I work that when I am at work, I get all of these kind of allergy-like, almost cold kind of symptoms that if I'm on vacation and I'm away for a few weeks or like even a long weekend, the symptoms go away. I come back to work. The symptoms come back.
So you're thinking about the building, and there must be something about the building that's causing
right.
this.
So what sort of work do you do?
I work in a library.
In a library. Okay. Old library, new library?
It's probably about 30 years old.
Okay. So, you know, it's not new construction. New construction actually has an issue because for some new construction, there are things that are preservatives, such as formaldehyde. They don't use formaldehyde anymore to preserve the plastic and insulation and other things, you know, within each of these buildings. Okay. So it's a 30-year-old building. What do you do there? Sit at a desk, work with the books?
A little bit of everything.
Okay.
Work with the books, help people find what they're looking for, work at the desk for a little while.
Okay. How's the ventilation in the library?
Usually when the seasons change and, like, the heater kicks on, that's when everything kind of gets a little bit worse.
Uh-huh. Well, things in the wintertime, things get worse because people have more viruses. That's one issue that's there. Here it is. You're working with the public. And so you're going to get a lot of viral infections from the public that you're working with. And it may not be due to the ventilation. It's a 30-year-old building. It's unusual. It would be sick building syndrome. Mm-hmm. Although ventilation can always be an issue, and talking to the people who run it and saying maybe in the wintertime you should leave the fan on with the furnace all the time. I think it's more likely that you're around people who
couldn't
are sick.
Couldn't be the books anyway?
Well, I was thinking about that. But usually if it's the books, it's musty and it's moldy, and you would know that. You know, you would, and usually ventilation is the issue. Is it musty at all?
Sometimes it just kind of depends on what part of the building you're in. Mm-hmm. But we did have a really bad leak in the roof that lasted maybe 4 years before they could afford to get it fixed, where the water was literally coming down from the ceiling like a waterfall.
Uh-huh. Well, so certainly the mustiness can be an issue, but frankly, mold is not as much of an issue. People don't like the sight of mold, and they blame mold on a whole bunch of things. That's pretty rare. Usually we're getting it person to person. My recommendation is Purell, or a generic Purell works well. The other thing, vitamin C really doesn't work to cut down on the cold. I wish it did. I was a fan of Linus Pauling years ago, but it really didn't do very much. Talk to them about ventilation in the building, improving the ventilation, because if you had a water leak like that, you're right. It may be moisture within the building that's making a difference. And that, of course, can increase the risk that you're going to get a cold or something like that. And my final recommendation is try to get it on the referendum to raise money in the city so you can keep your library working well without a waterfall. Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
Yep. Bye-bye. And before we take another short break, Zorba, let's go to our inbox for a pricey piece of advice from Teresa in Wichita, Kansas. She writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, I have some advice for listeners suffering from styes. When I would get them as a kid, my dad used to have me rub his gold wedding band on the top. Now, I still do that. It feels good, and it works like magic. And by the next day, it's gone. I hope you'll pass this tip along. Thanks."
I wonder if it works with a platinum wedding band, too. I wonder if it has to be gold. Well, gold is an inert substance, and it's possible that when she rubs it, she's actually massaging the stye, getting some of the pus and the infected material out of it, and that allows the stye to heal. So I would recommend that for anyone at the beginning stye, because we know warm, moist compresses work, but it may not just be the warmth. It may be the pressure. And if you want to use the gold ring, do it. But platinum may work as well, and even silver.
Oh, so it's just the pressure.
It must be that. I don't think it's the gold.
I could rub any old piece of stuff on the eye and it would have the same effect.
It might just have the same effect, yes.
Okay. Well, if you've got some eye-opening advice, send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have lots more of your calls coming up after we talk about something else that's pretty interesting. And later on, our medical myth buster. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, you want to talk some about wandering minds.
Right. And actually, as you were saying that, my mind was wandering. I was just thinking I am in big trouble because that means I'm going to age. Well, this is a very interesting data. Very provocative. Let's talk about telomeres. Now, telomeres are the ends of chromosomes. And there's some data that seems to show that every time we reproduce our chromosomes, and maybe it's every 100,000 reproductions or 10,000 or whatever, the telomeres get shorter and shorter. And as they get shorter, we age. Uh-huh. So what they did in this particular case is they looked at telomere length in women, and they looked at aging in women, mm-hmm. and they looked at whether or not they were happy or unhappy, and looked at the wandering mind, whether or not their mind wandered. And they did some psychological tests to look at that. Mm-hmm. And what they found is a few things. They found that in this particular study, the people who had minds that seemed to be more wandering had shorter telomere lengths, and they corresponded that to the fact that they might be 4 or 5 years older than their biological age based on this thing called telomere length. The people who did not have a wandering mind and who also appeared to be happier, that was the other issue, appeared to have a longer telomere length. So they looked at two things, happiness yeah. and wandering and telomere length, and they made a conclusion that a wandering mind might make you age more. What do you think?
We're talking about some subjective stuff here.
Absolutely.
Happiness, for example, even
right.
wandering
right.
mind.
Right.
You
right.
you may have it and not say you have it or
right.
not have
right.
it as much.
Exactly, exactly. So, but there are some issues in the contemplative sciences, which basically are looking at meditation, being sort of a charged
okay.
word that may be religious, and now it's called contemplation,
yeah.
that seem to show that if you engage in contemplation every day where you calm your mind, that you're able to do more and you may indeed be happier. And the question here is, does it change telomere length and does it actually keep you alive longer?
And the answer?
Well, I don't think there's a simple
answer
for this. If you look at functional MRI scanning in the brain, which has nothing to do with telomere length, we know that people who meditate are able to access different parts of their brain functionally with that. And maybe that affects genetic code, and maybe that affects how we age. But this is sort of new science, and I'm not exactly sure what I think about this.
I've been able to keep focus during this whole three
you know what? You know what? I've noticed that you've been on task, and since I've been looking at you, Tom, you have been looking younger and younger and younger, and obviously you have found the secret to a long, sweet life.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. It's, of course, toll-free. Back to the phone, Zorba, with a listener in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Zorba.
How can we help?
Well, my question is, I'm planning on starting a family in about 6 months, but I have a nasty habit I have to quit. I'm going to be quitting smoking. Is 6 months enough time for me to quit smoking and get, you know, my health back before I start planning a family?
Do you mean 6 months before your child is born or 6 months?
No, 6 months before we even start trying.
Before you even start trying. Well, first of all, as soon as you stop smoking, your body gets better. If you stop smoking today and you get pregnant tomorrow, you're going to have a baby that is really not involved with the smoke. Now, some may argue because the carbon monoxide levels in the body last there for a little bit of time, but they're absolutely minuscule by comparison to smoking. So you don't have to wait 6 months. You know, you can wait a day. 2 days,
oh,
a week.
That's a relief.
Yeah, there's no reason. It's not. You're not going to get more value at 6 months. It's while you are pregnant with the baby.
But when you say I'm going to quit smoking 6 months ahead of time, it might take you a long time to quit smoking.
Oh, you're right, Tom. No, it might take you a long time to quit smoking and make sure that you're off. Tom is exactly right, because it might take you a bit. And in fact, for some drugs such as Zyban, you have to have a quit date. You have to think about it. You start the medicine 1 week before you're actually going to quit. So Tom is quite right. The quitting is really the issue. But from a point of view of having a baby, once you quit smoking, you're fine. You'll be able to do it.
Do you have a method in mind to quit smoking?
I'm pretty much just going to go cold turkey and soldier through it.
Mm-hmm. How long have you smoked?
Less than a year, and I probably smoke maybe 5 cigarettes a day. My doctor said if I can get through the first week, I should be doing pretty good. He said day 3 is the hardest day to get through.
Uh-huh. It is hard to get through. Wait, I want to go back. How old are you?
I'm 32.
So you started smoking when you were 32 or 31?
When I was 31.
Yeah. Now, I just have a little question for you. It is a rare time in life to start smoking. You very rarely see 31-year-olds who say, hey, I'm going to take up smoking. I think it's good for me. How did you end up deciding to make that life choice of beginning to smoke at 31?
Well, I was a drinker. I was an alcoholic, and mm-hmm. I went through mm-hmm. rehab, and I kind of picked up a cross mm-hmm. addiction, mm-hmm. and I've been alcohol-free for 9 months now. That's the other reason we're waiting a few more months, is I really wanted to get through a whole year of sobriety before we even started planning a family,
mm-hmm.
and I've been doing really well with that. But when I went to rehab, everybody smoked. I was like, I'm going to do this too for a little while.
Very, very, very interesting.
Yeah, it is.
Very, very interesting. Well, first of all, right out of the box, congratulations on your sobriety.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.
You know, and as you know, it's one day at a time, and how wonderful that you have sobriety, and you said you're waiting for a year of sobriety to make sure that you're safe there. And you've gone through a lot of things with that sobriety. It is the same with tobacco products. Your doctor is right that first week is difficult, whether it's day one, day two, day three. It's a difficult first week. But just like with alcohol, it's something you have to be vigilant about. And many people do go back to smoking. Either after the baby is born, or they go back to smoking often after a month or two when they quit. But those are people often who are smoking a pack a day and have a long-standing habit. You've got a short habit, which was really more of a what I would call a social habit, and I think you're going to be really successful.
And wanting to have a kid, a good motivation to quit, I would think. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I would say quit now, and then when you feel the sobriety is really under control, you're not going to go back. Start having your kid, and then call us back and let us know if it's a boy or a girl.
I will.
Thank you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Again.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And Zorba, time now for our medical myth buster. Today's myth deals with the claim that our eyes can still be sun damaged even when it's cloudy.
Well, the answer is that your eyes can be sun damaged when it's cloudy because you can be in the middle of bright sun. Let's take, for example, when I'm skiing out in Colorado in Breckenridge on a cloudy day up at 10,000 feet, there's a lot of UV light that's going through and is affecting my eyes, even though I may not be squinting.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's not really retinal issues. There's something called photokeratitis, which is really a sunburn on the epithelium of the cornea, on the outside of the cornea that can produce it. So cloudy days, there's less sun, but some cloudy days and where you're living, it's still quite a bit of sun. So if it feels like there's a lot of sun out, cloudy or clear, wear your sunglasses because it will help.
Yeah. You can get sunburn when it's cloudy out.
That's right. Yeah. You can't get sunburn. And I, who ski a lot, have known that because I have gotten sunburn when I haven't used my sunscreen.
Have a blinding myth that's too bright to ignore? Just send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Now, Zorba, a listener with us in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hello, Dr. Zorba. How are you today?
Good.
What's up?
Well, I have a question regarding tendonitis. I have been experiencing it for a very long time, since I was in my early teens. It would show up, persist for a couple of weeks, and then fade away, usually with the start of some type of activity related to strenuous work or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But this particular time, it has not faded away. It is still with me after 10 months. And I'm wondering, is it normal for it to persist for such a lengthy period of time?
Any particular activity you think might be causing this or exacerbating it?
I am an extremely active person. My particular field is I'm a certified arborist and a spray technician. My job is to diagnose health problems with trees and treat them appropriately. So I'm frequently pruning. I have a spray gun that I have to squeeze the trigger all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't really have much of an opportunity to let the tendons rest and recover.
Really, what you really have is an overuse syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And so the real question for you is, are there ways that you can change some of the tools that you're using so you're not engaged in the same repetitive motion? That's one issue. The amount of time you're spending in the repetitive motion, but also how long you're doing it before you're switching. In other words, vary it throughout the day so that you're not doing the same exact motion time after time after time after time. That's one way of looking at it. So another way to look at it is look at other people who are doing the same thing and see whether or not they're doing it differently. In other words, you may be cutting in one way, but there may be another way. And it's a matter of using your arms more and your shoulder more, because as we get closer and closer to the torso, we get stronger and stronger. You know, the weakest muscles are in the hands and in the area around the wrist. That's kind of what I look
right
at. Now, do you take anti-inflammatories at all?
I have taken ibuprofen before, but it doesn't seem to be having any significant impact this time through.
Yeah, what do you
take? Generally, I take one or two tablets at a time.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a low dose. That's a very low dose. What I would recommend, two Aleve tablets twice a day. That's twice the dose that's on the bottle. Two in the morning, two in the evening, do it for 6 weeks automatically. think you need it, think you don't need it, take it every day. If your pain is better, then we know the anti-inflammatory will work for you. Then what you want to do is reduce the dose. So maybe one in the morning, one in the evening, wait a couple of weeks, see how that works out. If that works out well, you may find out you only needed one pill in the morning. But get the inflammation under control with a good dose. For a lot of people, that does it. When I go on my ski trips, I take two Aleve twice a day because I know I'm going to ache, and then I don't ache. And I don't ache.
Right.
You know, and I believe in medicines when you actually need it. But getting back to the real issue, it's how you're working that you want to try to attack this problem.
Yeah. With the job that I have, my tasks vary during the course of the day. Sometimes I prune. Sometimes I'm using a spray gun, and the drawback to the mm-hmm. spray gun is it's using both the muscles of the hand
right.
as well as the elbow when I bend it to raise this gun up into mm-hmm. the air so I can get the top of trees and the like. And,
right. I've got a few thoughts there. First of all, occupational therapists are remarkably good at looking at things like this. So you may want to call up your local hospital, talk to your occupational therapist okay. about it. And then the other thing is you may want to look at alternative ways to trigger the spray. Using your arms and squeezing together versus using your wrist and your grip. That would be another way of kind of looking at how to solve this problem for you.
Right.
Good luck.
Well, I do switch hands, so that does
helps.
Help alleviate it, but still not as much as I could wish.
That helps. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your information.
Yeah. Zorba, before we head out for the day, let's plow through a rather poetic edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. Today's literary critique comes to us from Joe in Franklin, Wisconsin, who writes, during a recent show, Zorba answered a question about sugar by saying, sugar is sugar is sugar. He then added that Edna St. Vincent Millay said the same thing years ago about roses. Well, Zorba knows a lot about medicine, but the line is actually from Gertrude Stein's 1922 poem, Sacred Emily, and reads, rose is a rose is a rose is a rose. So, Zorba, some poetic justice for Joe here. Do you have any defense?
Not at all. It's Gertrude Stein all the way, and you know what? I stand corrected.
Think Zorba needs to wake up and smell the roses? Then send your disagreement along to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We'll see you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
And you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. This show was produced by Gabrielle Pedriani. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich. And our technical director is Brad Colburn. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping that you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0105Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.